Today, a major Guardian investigation into the powerful fossil fuel industry and its impact on the world's climate emergency. And Gary Young on how to handle Donald Trump after that extraordinary letter to the Turkish president that leaked this week. This month, Guardian reporters from our Environment, Investigations and Data desks, based in the UK and across the world from the US to the Middle East to Australia, have come together to carry out an extraordinary examination of the world's climate emergency. They found that while it's fine to talk about all of our daily habits, whether it's how we eat, what we drive, or if we travel abroad, pointing the finger at each other has stopped us pointing it at a much bigger culprit.
The Polluter series is an attempt to refocus attention from individuals and consumption, because we all tend to blame ourselves for what's happening, and shift it towards the really big companies that have profited the most from sucking carbon out of the ground, a lot of which ends up in the atmosphere. So it's a sort of an attempt to name and shame those responsible, both the fossil fuel companies, the oil, the gas, the coal companies, but not just them, because they don't operate in a vacuum, but to show the structures around them.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, taking on the fossil fuel industry. You mentioned that it was time to kind of focus on the polluters as opposed to the individuals and individual action. Do you think for too long we have focused on consumers?
I think the balance has been wrong. I think individual consumers are an important part of the solution. And so it's right that people should recycle their plastic and eat less meat and fly less and all those things.
Jonathan Watts is The Guardian's global environment editor.
But none of that will matter unless there are really big systematic changes.
And you kicked off with some of the world's biggest multinational companies. Tell me what you found.
We commissioned an academic called Richard Heady, an American academic. Richard Heady is an absolutely remarkable man who, even when he was a student back in the 70s, was already thinking about energy problems.
I first started thinking about the fossil fuel industry when I was taking geology and environmental economics and wondering...
And realizing that it wasn't just about not having enough oil to survive another 10, 20 years, which was the priority then. He was already looking at what are the consequences of burning all this oil. So Heady's gone further than anyone in trying to work out which companies are responsible for which emissions. That is an incredibly complex task because there are hundreds of fossil fuel companies out there in countries across the world. So he's had to trawl through libraries.
Boston, Oxford, in London at the British Museum, in Sydney, Johannesburg.
And try and find company reports going back 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years and beyond. Try to find which companies are most responsible for the climate problem.
What he's found is that since 1965, the top 20 companies in the fossil fuel companies, so that's oil, gas and coal companies, are responsible for more than a third of all energy-related emissions.
The top polluters were a mix of public and private companies. Top of the list was Saudi Aramco. Then we also had Gazprom of Russia and the National Iranian Oil Company were all in the top 10. And then amongst private firms, top of them, historically, since 1965, was Chevron, followed by ExxonMobil, another US company, and then two European firms, BP from the UK and Shell from the Netherlands. When I say responsible, I mean they initially took it out of the ground. They didn't burn it all. We all have a share of that. But they are the kind of the starting point for all those emissions, and they made the most profits from all of those emissions. So he's sort of calculated, yeah, essentially who is at the center of the climate crisis.
And why did he start in 1965?
1965 was a key date.
The American company owning it say the rig has struck oil about 30 times, since geologists said there must be huge oil deposits underneath the sea.
Because that's the point when the U.S. president at the time, who was Lyndon Baines Johnson.
For over three centuries, the beauty of America has sustained our spirit and has enlarged our vision.
Heard from his scientific advisory committee that climate change was a huge problem.
The states and the cities, we will step up our effort to control harmful wastes. We will increase research to learn much more about the control of pollution.
And that there was a link between fossil fuels, carbon emissions, and warming of the planet. So that was more than half a century ago. That was when carbon emissions were just 10 billion tons a year. And within another 10 years, they were 20 billion, and now it's more than 40. So if we'd have done something in 1965, everything would have been so much easier than it is right now.
Let's go on hoping that we shall strike oil.
Richard Heady's clearly done an amazing thing. But I suppose the conclusion, the fact that massive fossil fuel companies are massive polluters, is one that we all knew to some extent. I mean, what impact do you hope that this information will have?
I think it's to quantify it as precisely as possible, because data always helps to bolster an argument. And I know that it's already been used in litigation cases against the big companies in the US and elsewhere, where you're having to prove a case to a judge that there was responsibility, that people in those companies were aware of some of the risks, and that they have been responsible for huge amounts of carbon emissions. So his data has helped to kind of shift the responsibility away from individual consumers. We're all partly to blame, but these companies have really got off lightly, and they continue to make these huge profits while we feel guilty about driving a car for a few extra hours.
Chevron's definitely done worse than me.
Just about. Only by a few billion tons, I hope.
I'm going to sleep well tonight. Okay, so you've got this amazing data. You go to the companies for their response. Not all of them come back to you, but some do. What do they say?
There's a number of arguments they make. The old argument is that, look, this is not how you calculate responsibility. The responsibility is generally calculated at the final point where you burn those fossil fuels and they go into the air. So that would be your car, or it would be your home for your heating, or whatever you do to finally use carbon emissions. So the responsibility would be with you. And they're saying, look, we just make the products. You can't blame us for how they're used. It's like the gun argument, you know, not the guns that kill people, it's people who kill people. It's kind of has a corollary with that.
You just told me it wasn't me who was to blame. Are you saying they're blaming me again?
They would love to blame you and put all the blame on you, Anoushka. The whole of the world's global climate problem is yours.
So seriously, they try to deflect the blame back to the consumer?
They say the end user. Yes, the consumer. And in one sense, that's exactly how climate emissions are generally calculated. When the United Nations, all the countries get together, they calculate at the final point where it goes up in the air, where the carbon emissions go up into the air. So that would be where the fuel is burned. And the whole point of Heady's research, and many campaigners, particularly Bill McKibben's really strong on this, is no, if you don't stop it at the source, then it's just going to flow into the market. You're going to create this huge industry. You're going to have companies that go out of their way to advertise to get us to have more cars, to spend more on luxury holidays in faraway parts of the world. And you're never going to deal with the problem. So you have to stop it at source.
It's extraordinary, really, that they try to argue that they exist in a vacuum, and that somehow, as the demand rises, they're simply the innocent party that is meeting that demand. Heady himself has said that he wants to send a message to oil and gas companies.
The core message is that they need to take the best science into account in making investment decisions and to adjust their investments, not only in additional production in the future, but also shifting investments towards renewables and carbon capture.
Is there any reason to think that inside the boardrooms and executive suites of these companies, these oil and gas chief executives are really grappling with the science of the climate crisis?
They clearly know the science. They've been, a lot of these companies have been doing the science themselves for decades and have actually contributed in a way to our understanding. But when it comes to acting on that science, that's a completely different thing. In all cases, they're putting their profits first. All of them essentially know there's a huge problem, yet all of them are planning to expand.
On the Gulf Coast, new ExxonMobil projects are expected to create over 45,000 jobs.
So they're going in the opposite direction. And some, which say they're doing the right thing and taking on board the warnings the most, in at least their statements.
All while reducing America's emissions. Energy lives here.
They're some of the ones that are planning to expand the fastest, and that includes Shell, and that includes ExxonMobil.
You spoke to someone with a bit of an inside view of these companies. Tell me about Jules Courtenhurst.
Jules Courtenhurst is someone who used to work for Shell.
The first 10 years of my career after graduating, I worked for Royal Dutch Shell.
And then had a life-changing moment when he was in South Africa on a sort of a team spirit building exercise. And they were hiking through the bush.
It was the bush, the animals, and us. Water was scarce. The river was dirty. So our guide, a Zulu, told us, I know a watering hole. It's about a three-hour hike from here. So we strapped on our backpacks and hiked, only to find the watering hole dry. And it was the harsh realization that we are in the end so dependent on Mother Nature, and that if, as human beings, we do not take care of Mother Nature, Mother Nature might not take care of us.
And so he shifted to focus on the climate emergency and try and persuade the oil industry to move away from pure extraction of fossil fuels and to develop more renewables. And he's been working on that some time now. So he's a really interesting character because he's had a foot in the fossil fuel industry.
And given his perspective, his insider perspective, does he say that the leaders of the big gas and oil companies are having a reckoning with climate science?
When Greta Thunberg went to speak at the United Nations in September of this year, there was a gathering of executives from the petrochemical industries. And he was there when they had a cocktail party. They all got together to discuss strategies and just to chit chat. And he was right in the room.
There was definitely a sense of unease in the room about the urgency of the pressure being applied on the industry. And the questions that that raises about what is often called in the industry their license to operate, their ability to be seen to be constructive players in society.
One of the problems for them, at least the problem from their side, is that oil executives were being asked by their own children, why is this happening? Is this true? Are these claims being made by the climate strikers real?
There's nothing that our children do as well as asking challenging and confronting questions at the dinner table, right?
And so the pressure's coming at them from the streets and from their own families.
I mean, what would it look like for one of these companies to overhaul its business strategy, to stop being a company that primarily extracts fossil fuels and to be a different sort of energy company instead?
It's a huge challenge. I mean, that has to be said from the beginning. They've spent the last 100 years honing their ability to suck oil and gas out of the ground, to pipe it across the world, put it into petrol stations or power generating factories, and to make a profit from that. And everything they've ever done is geared towards that. And now they're being asked to shift away towards more solar power or wind power. And you are starting to see some companies, particularly Shell, BP, invest more in these types of energy, but it's still a tiny, tiny fraction of their overall interests.
You mentioned BP and Shell. Are they doing it more so than, for example, Chevron or ExxonMobil?
The perception amongst just about every environmental campaigner or academic that I've spoken to is that the European companies have been much more open about the problems and have tried to engage more with climate change and the challenges it poses than the big oil and gas companies in the United States. I think even the CEOs who want to do something, who are worried about their kids, they can't just turn their companies around on a dime.
The CEOs of these companies can only make this transition to the extent that their shareholders will allow them to. And the role of institutional investors in helping drive this transition is therefore absolutely crucial.
They have an obligation first and foremost to shareholders. And shareholders generally just want profits. And the biggest shareholders are these huge asset management companies and investment banks.
Okay, let's talk more about investors. How much of a role do they really have?
Investors are hugely, hugely powerful, especially companies that control big funds, so these asset managers. One of my colleagues, Patrick Greenfield, he was looking at the financial industry and their role in this problem. And he found that the big three asset management companies, that is BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street, together control $300 billion worth of climate change assets. He also found that they have actually increased their holdings in fossil fuel assets by more than 30% since the Paris Climate Agreement. That was the point when the world was supposed to have got together to say, okay, we've got to phase down fossil fuels.
Today's a historic day in the fight to protect our planet for future generations. 10 months ago in Paris, I said before the world that we needed a strong global agreement to reduce carbon pollution and to set the world on a low carbon course. The result was the Paris Agreement.
What did they do? They ramped up their investment. So this shows that if they're not on board with radical change, with a transition to renewable energy, then there's just going to be this torrent of money pouring into oil and gas companies. They're going to want a place for it to go, so they'll be investing it in new oil fields, in Alaska, in Argentina, in all sorts of places where it really needs to be kept in the ground.
You spoke to one of the top three managers, Ron O'Hanley, the head of State Street, which is one of the big investors you mentioned. He oversees $2.2 trillion in funds. That's many of our pension funds. And he's trying to make the climate crisis an investing priority. What did he say?
I talked to him with my colleague Patrick Greenfield, and he was telling us that he was concerned.
We have concluded that climate is most certainly a long-term risk to the system.
That he would be looking to boards of directors in these companies proving that they are taking the climate crisis seriously and that they are taking that on board as part of their future business plans.
We don't run these companies, but what we are looking for, starting with the board, is that there's evidence that they're taking into account the risks that are facing these companies long term and that they're overseeing the action plans around them. So
he's basically saying to them, look, you can't ignore climate anymore. You've got to make it part of your calculations, part of your business plan. Otherwise, we're going to use our huge weight to start pushing certain executives who are holding things up out of their posts.
What's his incentive to do that?
I think it's a combination of social pressure. He knows everybody's talking about it at the moment. And also, in the end, there's a real risk that these assets are going to be stranded. If these companies don't change and there is a transition, which all the governments are signed up to, then companies that don't adjust are going to get left behind.
And your colleague Damien Carrington recently spoke to Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England.
Hello, Damien Carrington.
Hi, Damien, it's Mark Carney.
Hi, thanks so much for calling. I appreciate it.
About the impact of the climate crisis on the financial sector. He also talked about companies needing to take the long view for their own health.
I'm going to quote a banker, unusually, I don't normally quote bankers.
Okay.
Where James Gorman, who is the CEO of Morgan Stanley, said the other day, well, if you don't have a planet, you're not going to have a very strong financial system. So
what he's saying makes complete sense, but is it something the rest of the financial world is ready to hear?
Companies in the financial sector do not move that rapidly. If they can find a place where they can make profits, they will continue to make profits. Mark Carney is saying, let's tweak the regulations, let's change things so that companies that move in the right direction, away from fossil fuels, are rewarded. Those that are slow to move will be punished by the markets. He wants capitalism to fix the problems of capitalism. And he speaks very candidly about the risks. And he says, the longer we wait for this transition, the bigger the risk that the transition will cause a financial shock caused by and a sudden attempt to move away from fossil fuels. So we need to start now and move as quickly as we can.
Where do you fall on this question? Is financial pressure going to be the fastest and most effective way to push these companies to change?
I think it is in Europe and the United States. It's absolutely essential. We have to understand, though, that that won't happen without political change. So political change has to be at the top. So even the governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, has said,
the financial sector isn't a substitute for climate policy, for government policy.
Right.
It can help, it can accelerate, but the markets alone cannot fix everything. So ultimately, you need to have a government willing to act.
Okay, let's talk about politics. We've talked about the fact that people care so much more about the climate crisis now than they did just a few years ago. And here in the UK, we saw Jeremy Corbyn dramatically declare a climate emergency on the floor of Parliament just a few months ago.
Today, Mr. Speaker, this House must declare an environment and climate emergency. We have no time to waste.
Some might say that's political messaging, but it was still a step in a particular direction. Now, you and your colleagues devised a scorecard for seeing how different MPs measure up when it comes to specific policies that affect carbon emissions. What did you find?
Yeah, the MP's scorecard, by the way, is an incredible piece of work by Pamela Duncan, a data journalist. What we found was a huge divergence between the parties. But perhaps even more importantly, what we found was that any MP whose party is in power is less likely to vote for action. It's been very easy for opposition parties to call for the right thing. But as soon as they get power, they withdraw somewhat from taking the most radical steps necessary.
That's so depressing.
It is. I mean, I suppose it's true of an awful lot of policies. The other thing that's really clear is that, unlike the US, we don't have such a polarity between the two main parties about accepting climate science or not accepting climate science. Almost all MPs agree that in climate, mainstream climate science, and want to do something about it. There's also huge agreement in long-term goals. The UK now has one of the most ambitious long-term goals in the world, which is that we're going to go carbon neutral by 2050. This is an incredible thing. The problem is that when it comes to taking short-term measures that can actually achieve those goals, there's a lot of resistance, particularly by parties in power and particularly by the Conservative Party, which has been in power the longest. So we're great at setting goals for our children and our children's children. We're not so good about doing what's needed right now.
I'm hearing a theme here.
Yes, I'm sure lots of listeners will not be too surprised about this.
I think you might describe it as kicking the can down the road.
It's totally kicking the can down the road, but at least agreeing on what direction the can needs to be kicked.
Well, at least we know that. And when it comes to votes, now you looked at individual MPs. What kind of response did you get to your analysis? I imagine there were a number of them who weren't too pleased with their scorecard.
You're absolutely right. The most notable bad score was Boris Johnson, who got zero. Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, was joint bottom with many other Conservative MPs, one DUP MP, Sammy Wilson, who's a notorious sceptic.
Given that this is a Prime Minister who has claimed that he wants to be an environmentally friendly Prime Minister.
Collectively, we have to do better if we're going to avoid a catastrophic climate change, loss of habitat, destruction of reefs, loss of forest.
That is pretty astonishing.
I think it's awful. Our scorecards were not intended as a final word. But what we hope is that they will get voters to question their MPs and say, look, I can see your score here, here, here. I know you have registered interests with an oil company. Are you representing my interests? Because for me, the climate is a priority. You know, we all have lots of different priorities, jobs and Brexit and all these other things. But unless climate really rises up as one of the issues that MPs feel that they're going to be judged on, then nothing's going to change.
And it has risen up, hasn't it? I mean, I just want to ask you, because you did that episode with us in January. It's been 10 months. Have things changed in the last 10 months?
I think it's been amazing how this issue has risen up the agenda. I mean, unthinkable even a year ago, how far we've come. So in terms of awareness, in terms of opinion polls, when you look at, are the public worried now? Yes, they're much more worried. So, and they should be worried. We should all be worried. But now we're reaching the point where how do we translate that worry into attention and action? And I think that's the kind of the next step. The next election is going to be fundamental, because although it's looking like it's going to be a Brexit election, the other thing that's absolutely key is that the next winner of an election will probably be in power for 5 years, or could be in power for 5 years. That's half the time we have left to get emissions down by 2030. So the next party in power will have an absolutely fundamental place in history, for good or for bad. So climate really should be on the ballot paper.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much indeed.
That was Jonathan Watts, The Guardian's Global Environment Editor. The Polluters series has been a collaboration across The Guardian. I'm not going to be able to name everyone involved, but other key contributors include Matthew Taylor, Damien Carrington, Pamela Duncan, Patrick Greenfield, Sandra Laville, Fiona Harvey, Stephanie Kirchgassner and Adam Morton. The series was edited by Natalie Hanman and Nick Hopkins. You can find all the reporting on the website. Coming up, Gary Young on Donald Trump. Now, this week, an extraordinary letter from Donald Trump to President Erdogan was leaked to Fox News. After US troops withdrew from northern Syria, paving the way for a cross-border offensive from Turkey, Trump wrote, "Let's work out a good deal. You don't want to be responsible for slaughtering thousands of people, and I don't want to be responsible for destroying the Turkish economy, and I will." The president signed it off, "Don't be a tough guy, don't be a fool. I will call you later." It has since been reported that the Turkish president threw the letter into the bin. It was so unexpected that some correspondents believed it was a hoax. Others began to question President Trump's mental health. The Guardian's Gary Young responds.
Over the last couple of weeks, there have been increasing concerns about US President Donald Trump's mental health. I am not a mental health professional, and I'm in no way capable of diagnosing President Trump's state of mental health. And to be honest, I find it objectionable when that is used as a slur against people. But more than that, I think that this is not about one man and his mind. First of all, Trump did not get there on his own. 63 million, almost, Americans voted for him. He has been buttressed by his party, financial interests, and a significant section of the media. His approval rating is 40%, which is quite low for a president, but that's still 40% of people who think he's doing a good job, which is a different way of saying that if this is a case of insanity, then it is one that is both collective and mass, that has institutional and systemic support. He is not a man on his own. He serves not just himself, but a set of interests and a purpose. He is also wedded to a series of beliefs by which I mean misogyny, racism, xenophobia, white supremacy, nationalism, which are not psychological, but political. Even as he seems to be acting irrationally, he's not acting erratically. He finds his target. He's not attacking randomly white people or gun owners or the Christian right. He reserves his ire for the black and the brown, the weak and the poor, the foreign, the Muslim, the immigrant. And it's the same, more or less, the same kind of people that get attacked by him all the time. If this was purely an idiosyncratic kind of set of characteristics that marked him out as one of a kind, why then can we look at Silvio Berlusconi, the former premier of Italy, or Boris Johnson, and see similar behaviour in terms of their cavalier attitude to democratic norms, their views about women, their accusations of sexual harassment, their casual racism? In many ways, these things are one of a kind. He is an emblem of a moment in politics, particularly right-wing populist politics, and particularly, I would say, white supremacy, and that most of the characteristics that he is exhibiting, looking for someone to blame, opportunism, ineptitude, rage, a kind of set of contradictory behaviours, are all actually fairly consistent with where white supremacy and white nationalism would be in this moment, raging at a world that in which it is still dominant but doesn't quite control. Ultimately, there may be a medical or therapeutic intervention that could help him. But there would need to be a political intervention to help us get rid of him.
That was Gary Young. Huge thanks to him and to Jonathan Watts, as well as to Richard Heady, Jules Cortenhurst, Ron O'Hanley, and Mark Carney, as well as to the whole of the reporting team who produced the Polluters series. This juggernaut of an episode was produced by Mithali Rao and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.